Oh, yes. It is a pleasure to be back here in Toronto after been gone for decades, perhaps, a decade. Ultra-cold atoms is a beautiful field, and there is lots of beautiful things you can show with that are nice to see. Effective field theory is kind of a theoretical method, so it's a little bit dry. I'm using ultra-cold atoms as an excuse to try to explain the ideas of effective field theory, which have proven to be very powerful in high-energy physics. It's a universal language for discussing many aspects of physics there. And it's also proving to be quite powerful in ultra-cold atoms. And it might be that there is a problem of interest to you where it might also be good. Yes. Okay, so what I'm going to begin is try to explain what is effective field theory. And I'll illustrate effective field theory by using the field theory that people have heard of most, which is quantum electrodynamics. And then I'll turn to ultra-cold atoms and try to give at least a sketch of how it might apply in that field. Okay, so first of all, in high-energy physics, it's the universal framework for discussing low-energy approximations to the standard model of particle physics. And Mike Luke can tell you all you want to know about that. It's also the framework for carrying out model-independent analyses of new higher energy physics beyond the standard model. And Bob Holdham certainly makes use of that. And so what is the basic idea? Well, the general setup is you have a problem where you have low energy degrees of freedom and you have higher energy degrees of freedom. And in physics, we learn how to divide and conquer, separate problems into pieces, how to ignore some aspects of the problem and understand things in a more simple way. The basic principles of effective field theory is first that you can describe the low energy behavior with arbitrarily high accuracy using only low energy degrees of freedom. And it's everyone is familiar with the idea that you can understand low energy behavior without knowing at least approximately without worrying about the high energy details. But the idea is you can understand it with arbitrarily high accuracy without taking into account high energy physics explicitly. And also the effects of high energy degrees of freedom on low energy are smooth. That is, they're analytic, and that's a great simplifying thing. When you see non-analytic behavior, that comes from low energy degrees of freedom interacting among themselves, but the effects from high energy are always smooth. Well, let me give you an illustration of this. Let's say a cartoon version of how one might apply effective field theory. Back in 1887, the Michelson-Morley experiment implied that light travels at the same speed, c, independent of the velocity of the emitter or absorber. And once you realize that there is some new constant of nature, it suggests that Newton's laws probably ought to be modified somehow to take into account this new constant of nature. And you'd certainly expect dramatic effects at high velocities comparable to the speed of light. But you should also expect small effects, even at low velocity. And one of the simplest ways to quantify Newton's laws is the kinetic energy. It's just simply 1/2 mv squared. And this suggests that somehow we should modify this if we want, that somehow this new constant of nature would require modifying Newton's laws. So how would an effective field theorist look at this? Well, they would, first of all, examine the symmetries of the problem. The symmetries, well, there's rotational invariance that tells you that the energy must be a function of the velocity, which is the square root of the sum of the squares of the components. Next, the effects of high energy on low energy should be smooth. That is, this energy should be an analytic function of the components, Vx, Vy, and Vz. And that tells you that E must, in fact, have an expansion powers of V squared, not V. Dimensional analysis tells you that higher powers of V squared must be compensated by 1 over C squared. And so you're led to proposing a modified kinetic energy that would look like what we have here at the bottom. The energy is the good old 1/2 mv squared of Newton. And then there are corrections that could be V to the 4th over C squared, V to the 6th over C to the 4th, and so on, with unknown coefficients. And these are just numerical coefficients. And so this is what you would be, this is what you would be led to. And then the problem is then to figure out what are these coefficients. And so you could maybe carry out very careful experiments and learn that C1 is 0.4 plus or minus 0.1, and maybe start to see what C2 is. It's a very methodical and modest approach to physics. But it's a systematically improvable approach. At low energies, by adding first the first correction, then the second correction, you get higher and higher accuracy. The effects of high energies are reduced to constants, just single numbers. And there's a hierarchy of importance. The C1 is the most important, C2 is the next, and then so on. And finally, it gives you a model-independent framework for analyzing the effects of this new scale. And if anyone has a model for how the speed of light should come in, they could be expressible in terms of these coefficients. Now, let me give you a quote from some wise person. As we know, there are known knowns. There are things we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns, the ones we don't know. Well, so this 1/2 mv² is the known known. These other terms that are known unknowns, we know there ought to be corrections of that form, we just don't know the coefficients. But of course, there also can be unknown unknowns. For example, at this time, it wasn't too many decades before quantum mechanics would come along, and that would have certainly qualified as a known unknown. Anyway, well, in 1905, there was a revolution in physics, and that was from Albert Einstein, who presented the general theory of relativity, which told us that the actual formula for the energy is this nice, simple analytic expression. If you expand it out, you find that those coefficients are 3/8 and then 5/16, and you can find out all the ones you want to know beyond that. It predicts the numerical coefficients, and of course, it also introduces an enormous new insight, this idea of the rest mass, E equals mc squared. So this is the kind of physics we admire the most, and if we can make a revolution in physics, we'd all be very pleased with ourselves. Physics doesn't always proceed through revolutions like that. Sometimes there are physics proceeds through more systematic and careful work, and effective field theory is a guiding principle for that aspect of physics. It's no substitute for the revolutions like this, but it's a way to make progress in between those revolutions. Okay, so that was a cartoon version. So let me turn to what effective field theory is more explicitly. Well, first, classical field theory just involves functions of space that evolve with time. And the classic example is electromagnetism. The electric and magnetic fields are fields that evolve with time according to Maxwell's equations. But you can also introduce fields for density and magnetization and other fields that involve average behavior of various physical phenomena. What is quantum field theory? Well, quantum field theory is a field theory with fields that do not commute. The standard ways they don't commute are two. They can fail to commute because of commutation relations through equations like this. And when you take a field theory course, what you learn is that the translation of an equation like this is that phi dagger creates a particle at the point x, phi annihilates a particle at the point x, and also that the particles that they do this for are identical bosons. Another way they can fail to commute is through anti-commutation relations involving an equation like this. And again, you learn in field theory courses that what this means is that phi dagger creates a particle at point x, phi annihilates a particle at point x, and the particles are identical fermions. So as far as I'm concerned, my answer to be what is quantum field theory is that it describes the quantum mechanics of point particles in a way that automatically takes into account the behavior of identical bosons and identical fermions. It's also simple if you have a local quantum field theory where these point particles interact through a point. And when we use effective field theory, you're usually taking advantage of local quantum field theories to make life simple. But the main point is to have point particles where you take into account identical particles automatically. So let me go through the most well-known quantum field theory that there is, and that is quantum electrodynamics. The degrees of freedoms are photons, electrons, positrons. Each of them has two spin states. We often draw them with represent by diagrams where a photon is a wiggly line and electrons and positrons are straight lines. The time evolution of these particles can be described succinctly in terms of a Lagrangian, which is just 1/2 e squared minus b squared in the appropriate units, plus electron-positron terms. And those terms tell you that the only interaction is a point interaction where a photon can couple to an electron-positron. It has one interaction parameter. This is the fine structure constant alpha, 1 over 137. Well, let me skip quantum chromodynamics since I ran out of time to expand that. So let me turn, how would you construct an effective field theory for QED? Suppose you're looking at the cosmic microwave background. You're at such low energies that there's no way to produce electron-positron pair. So you're just dealing with photons. Well, let me first summarize the strategy of effective field theory. First of all, you identify the low energy degrees of freedom. They'll have some momentum scale p. So in case of the microwave background, it's the energy of these microwave photons, which is 3 keV, or 3 Kelvin. There's also high energy degrees of freedom, which have momentum scales above some scale. In this case, it's the scale of the electron-positron pairs that you could create. In the microwave background, you're way below that scale. So you have your low energy degrees of freedom have much lower energy. The strategy is to describe the low energy degrees of freedom using a local quantum field theory. It'll have infinitely many parameters, which sounds like a big step backward. We had QED with one parameter, and we're going to infinitely many. But we're going to choose the parameters in a way that's scale, so they scale as definite powers of this large scale. And what that's going to do for us is guarantee that the effects of in these constants are suppressed by p over lambda to that scale. And that's where we'll win in spite of adding more parameters. So let's go through it in more detail. Okay, here's QED. We have photons, electrons, positrons. Lagrangian is e squared minus b squared. There's a point interaction. We're going to, at energies below the threshold for electron-positron pairs, we can't produce them, but they still have effects because low-energy photons can scatter. They can scatter through virtual electron-positron pairs. Those low-energy photons can be described by QED. Just calculate Feynman diagrams like that, and it's a lot of work. But they can be described much more simply and also to arbitrarily high accuracy by using an effective field theory where the only degrees of freedom are the photons. So let's see how that works. Okay, let me call it quantum photon dynamics. It's a low-energy theory with photons only. The fields are the E and B fields. What does the Lagrangian look like? Well, it should respect the symmetries of QED. The gauge invariance says that this effective Lagrangian must be a function of the electric and magnetic fields only. Those involve involve derivatives of the scalar and vector potentials, but gauge invariance says that the Lagrangian must be a function of those only. Lorentz invariance says they have to be functions of particular combinations, namely E squared minus B squared and E dot B are the only Lorentz invariant combinations. And finally, parity tells us that it has to be an even function of B. And once you have that, you can start writing down all the possible terms in the Lagrangian. So here's the first term, E squared minus B squared. You can have E squared minus B squared squared. You can have E dot B squared because it's quadratic in B, and so on. What do they tell you? Well, the zeroth approximation is just it's the good old Maxwell's equation going back to 1861. It just describes free photons. What if you add the next term? Well, this was actually discovered by Euler and Heisenberg back in 1936, so we're not making very rapid progress here. The next term is these with unknown coefficients, but it tells you if you take a field theory course, you'll learn that something like this will tell you that there's photon-photon scattering. It's quadratic in the fields. It gives you diagrams where four things come in and out, so two photons in, two photons out. Now, you can determine these coefficients because back in QED, There are diagrams like this, which allow photon-photon scattering. You can calculate them and find out what the scattering is, and then find these coefficients. And they're simply numerical coefficients times alpha squared over m electron squared. And if you look at the structure of the interactions, you'll find that the amplitudes that they give are proportional to p squared over m electron squared. And that means at large momentum p, or at small momentum p, they're going to be highly suppressed. If you go on to the next level, you'll find e squared minus b squared cubed, e squared minus b squared times e dot b squared. You'll find 6 photon amplitudes that allow 2 photons to scatter and produce 4, or they allow 3 to scatter. They have coefficients that'll be 1 over e m to the 4th, and amplitudes that are p to the 4th over m to the 4th. And if p is very small, these will be very small effects. Anyway, this is the effective Lagrangian. These are the first few terms. There's infinitely many interaction parameters, so we've taken a big step backwards. But these parameters scale in a very specific way. Then at each order, they become higher powers in the mass of the electron. And that means that there's every time you go to the next level, there's a higher suppression factor. And you can get arbitrarily high accuracy just by adding more and more terms, because you'll get errors that are smaller and smaller, higher and higher powers of momentum over mass. They're therefore very, very small. And so, for example, if I look at the cosmic microwave background, energy scale of photons is 3 Kelvin. Energy scale of electron-positron pairs is 10 to the 6 electron volts. There's a huge hierarchy of 10 to the minus 10. So if you want 10 to the minus 20 accuracy, if that's good enough, you keep that second term. If you want higher 10 to the minus 40 accuracy, you include another term. And, of course, there's always the possibility of unknown unknowns. These are quantifying the known unknowns. Of course, the unknown unknowns might, at some point, interfere with this accuracy. But it gives you a way to get arbitrarily high accuracy using only the low energy degrees of freedom. Let me just back up for a second. These coefficients were figured out way back in 1936, so what's new here? Well, what's new and what was realized by Steven Weinberg around 1970 is that you can take this Lagrangian and treat it as a quantum field theory. These coefficients came from already doing quantum mechanics, and so you might think that's illegal to do quantum mechanics and then do it again. But in fact, this thing is structured in such a way that if you take this Lagrangian and do quantum mechanics, allow the photons to scatter and rescatter, everything will be consistent. You'll be able to reproduce the effects of QED in a much more simple way, but with as much accuracy as you want. Okay, so that's the general philosophy. Well, as I mentioned, in high energy physics, this is the universal language for describing various things. One of them is to look at the effects of low energy on physics beyond the Standard Model. In high energy physics, the high energy frontier is what is being pursued at the LHC by people in the ATLAS and CMS and other collaborations. What they're trying to do is create new heavy particles at the LHC. And if they can do that, that's great. It's another way to try to get at the same physics is through the precision frontier. Try to observe the effects of virtual heavy particles by doing very precise measurements at low energy. And that's where effective field theory can come in. Effective field theory tells us the effects of virtual heavy particles can be described to arbitrary accuracy in terms of standard model particles alone. You don't have to include the heavy particles explicitly. All their effects can be captured in terms of coefficients, in terms of interaction coefficients. Whoops, I'm missing. Okay, put the slides wrong. And just as an illustration, one of the most important effects of virtual heavy particles in the Standard Model comes from the propagator corrections to the W boson, the Z boson, and also photon Z mixing. Those propagator corrections can be described by constants. They're conventionally called S, T, and U. They're very strongly constrained by precision electroweak measurements. And they tell us, for example, that S is minus 0.04 plus or minus 0.09. it tells us that the propagator of the Z boson, of these propagators, cannot have corrections beyond the few percent level. And this is an extremely strong constraint that must be represented, must be respected by any model for new heavy particles that can be produced at the LHC. And so when Bob Holdham comes up with a new theory of physics beyond the standard model, one of the first things he has to do is check these constraints, all that are captured in terms of three numerical constants. Okay. It's also, this is also useful simply as a way of developing approximations to the standard model, systematically improvable low-energy approximations. And one of the classic examples is heavy quark effective theory, which Mike Luke was one of the pioneers of. This is an effective theory for the sector of quantum chromodynamics that has one heavy quark, which is a bottom quark or a charm quark. If you have a bottom quark, this particle containing a bottom and a bottom quark and a light anti-quark is called a B meson. The energy scale of the light quark we conventionally call lambda QCD. The heavy quark mass is much larger by an order of magnitude. And this heavy quark effective theory gives us a systematic way of expanding in lambda QCD over the heavy quark mass. And this heavy quark effective theory is the basis for the analysis of all the experiments at the B factory that have established the CKM mechanism for CP violation. Okay, so that, and let me finally turn to cold atom physics, where I can now show some nice, beautiful pictures. So cold atom physics is the study of atoms that have been trapped and cooled using laser beams to cool down to extremely low temperatures in the micro nanokelvin region. This trapping was the result of the Nobel Prize in 1997 by Chu Ko and Tunuji and Phillips. One of the great, a picture that's become one of the icons of ultra-cold physics is this, the experiment on Bose-Einstein condensation of atoms by the picture by the Gila group of Cornell and Wyman, where they took rubidium-87 atoms. If you haven't seen it, well, you've probably seen it before, but anyway, just to remind you, these are pictures of the momentum distribution of cold atoms when you lower the temperature. And what you find is that at low temperatures, they're a nice, smooth, kind of like a Gaussian distribution. And then at lower temperatures, suddenly this is velocity distribution, so there's a peak develops at zero velocity. This is the onset of Bose-Einstein condensation. And as you lower the temperature more and more, eventually this Gaussian background disappears, and all you get is this pure peak of a pure Bose-Einstein condensate. Okay, and this was the Nobel Prize of 2001 for Cornell, Wyman, and Ketterle. Another important development was that they were able to cool fermions down to the point of quantum degeneracy. This was first accomplished with potassium-40 atoms by the Gila group, by Jin, in January 2001. These are pictures from the Hewlett group at Rice, which shows lithium-6 atoms. It's very hard to cool fermions by themselves because cooling requires that the atoms scatter against each other. What they use is evaporative cooling, where they throw away the most energetic atoms, rely on the others to scatter and go back to re-equilibrate. If they don't scatter, they won't equilibrate. And fermions stop scattering at low energy. But this, what they did is use sympathetic cooling. They used lithium-7 atoms, which are bosons that can be cooled into a Bose-Einstein condensate, in the same trap as lithium-6 atoms. And so you can cool the lithium-7 atoms readily, and they cool the lithium-6 atoms. And what you see as you lower the temperature, that the lithium-7 atom cloud gets smaller and smaller because it's getting closer and closer to a Bose-Einstein condensate. At some point, the lithium-6 atom stops shrinking, and that's because the quantum degeneracy pressure of the fermions stops them, and they start filling up a Fermi sphere instead. Okay, so how would I apply the ideas of effective field theory to ultra-cold atoms? Well, a sufficiently fundamental theory for my purposes is that the cold atoms are described by the many-body Schrodinger equation for atoms in a trapping potential. This is often a three-dimensional harmonic oscillator potential. And they're interacting through an intra-atomic potential. that will involve short-range repulsion, medium-range attraction, and then their van der Waals tail. And there are complications from hyperfine spin states and multiple scattering channels, so it's really a complicated multi-channel scattering problem. But if you have this, you can go ahead and calculate the scattering of atoms. For example, you can solve the Schrodinger equation to find the scattering phase shifts, and from those you can read off the cross-section. If you do that and take the scattering phase shifts and expand them in power of the momentum, the first term you'll get is determined by the scattering length. The second term is called the effective range. And the effective range comes in with a factor of momentum squared. And so at very low momentum, this will come in with a suppression factor of momentum squared. And so this is, in fact, what you need to develop the effective field theory. This scattering length will be something that governs the behavior, the leading behavior. This will be one of these corrections that you can, if you want more and more accuracy, you can include this. And if you want higher accuracy yet, you can take into account the next term in the expansion. Okay, so the way we do effective field theory we have a low energy expansion for the scattering involving these parameters. We would construct an effective field theory with point interactions that will reproduce this low energy expansion. So it'll be just atoms interacting at a point. The most important parameter is scattering length. And then if you want higher accuracy, you need to include the effective range. And if you want higher accuracy yet, you include more parameters. And the more you include, the higher accuracy you want. Often the scattering length is all you need. And there's a lot of beautiful physics that can be done with the scattering length only. Well, one amazing aspect of ultra-cold atoms is that this scattering length, this most important interaction parameter, can actually be controlled by the experimentalist. If you use magnetic fields, if you adjust the magnetic field, in most regions of magnetic field, nothing very interesting happens. The parameters slowly evolve the magnetic field. But there are special values of the magnetic field where the scattering length will suddenly go to minus infinity and then come back from plus infinity and go back to its normal, slowly varying value. These are called Feshbach resonances, and they tell you that by adjusting the magnetic field, you can get the scattering length to become arbitrarily large by tuning to this special value. And that's interesting because infinite scattering length means that the scattering cross-section saturates the unitarity bound. You have the strongest interactions that are possible that are allowed by quantum mechanics. Also, infinitely strong interactions, such as this A is infinity, provide no length scale. So you have interactions that are scale invariant. And one of the very interesting questions is, what is the behavior of condensed matter when you have infinitely strong scale invariant interactions? And the study of that problem has been one of the major themes of ultra-cold atom physics in the last decades. It's one of the things that Professor Thywissen is working on. One example question you can ask, for example, what is the mechanism for superfluidity in the ground state? And this has provided a nice experimental validation of work from decades ago. Two possible mechanisms for superfluidity that hold in very different regimes of scattering length are the BEC mechanism, in which you have the Bose-Einstein condensation of molecules. This is exemplified this picture here, where molecules form little tiny pairs. And another opposite mechanism is the one responsible for superconductivity, that is the formation of Cooper pairs near the Fermi surface. And this is an attempt to illustrate that, where you have pairs that are very far apart compared to the spacing of atoms. And experimentally, it's been verified, well, it was predicted decades ago, and I should have apologized, I ran out of time to put in all the appropriate acknowledgments to the people who predicted the crossover, but it was experimentally verified that there's a very smooth crossover from BEC to BCS as the scattering length goes from positive to negative values through plus and minus infinity. Okay, well, this is supposed to be a talk on effective field theory, so what has effective field theory done for us? Well, one thing it can do is allow you to improve precision. Well, one thing it can do is allow you to understand, help you understand what are the corrections to the system you're considering, and perhaps quantify the quantify the size of the corrections. But I'm just going to give you a couple examples where it has had a much more significant effect. And so the first example will, to introduce that, let me point out that this, when you have a very large scattering length, when you tune that, use that Feshbach resonance to tune the scattering to be very large, much larger than the range, then there is universal behavior that's determined only by the scattering length, and it's especially universal in the infinite scattering length limit. But among the universal behavior you'll see is that cross sections have very simple forms. For bosons, it's 8 pi times a squared. At low energy, at high energy, it's 8 pi over me. And this is just the unitarity limit, the largest possible cross section allowed by unitarity. Another universal aspect is that if the scattering happens to be positive, there's a diatomic molecule. Its binding energy is going to zero, like 1 over a squared, and its radius is getting increasingly large. The size of this molecule is 1/2 a, so when you tune the scattering length to be 100 times the size of the scale of atomic interactions, this molecule is also 100 times larger than the standard scale for molecules. Well, so in way back in 1970, there was an amazing prediction by a guy named Vitaly Efimov that when you tune that scattering length to infinity and you get this diatomic molecule that grows larger and larger, something even more bizarre happens in the three-body problem. Namely, when A goes to infinity, there are infinitely many triatomic molecules. In addition to this one diatomic molecule that's getting bigger and bigger, there's infinitely many triatomic molecules. There's one that'll be a size whose size is about the standard range of a molecule, then one that's larger by a factor of 23, one that's larger yet by a factor of 23, and one that's larger yet. These molecules have an accumulation point at the threshold. They have binding energies that differ by factors of 1 over 515, and the sizes differ by this factor of 23. And this was, at first, there was a lot of skepticism of this result. This was a young guy in the Soviet Union and came up with this, and in the West, there was skepticism, but people looked at it carefully and said, sure enough, it is true. And the problem is to find out, can we see this in nature? And there were attempts to look at it in nuclear physics, but the problem is that nuclear physics aren't very close to this large scattering length limit. Maybe the scattering lengths are large by a factor of 3. That's not very good. Helium atoms are a very good candidate. They have a scattering length that's 30 times larger than the natural scale. So that's pretty large. But, in that case, it turns out that there's two triatomic molecules in helium, if you believe theoretical calculations. Only one has been observed, and that's the more compact one. And so this marvelous feature that things get larger and larger isn't being observed. So anyway, helium, it looked good, but the technology wasn't there to really verify these predictions. But ultra-cold atoms, in ultra-cold atom physics, it was verified. There's a discovery of Efimov trimer in cesium-133 atoms by the Innsbruck group in November 2005. This figure is showing the loss rate of atoms. So this is a resonance in the loss rate as they vary the scattering length, which means varying the magnetic field. At a very particular point, there's a huge increase in the loss rate. Here, they call this a recombination length, but what they've done is taken the loss rate scales like lengths to the fourth. They've taken the fourth root. So when you see a factor of 10 variation here, it's a factor of 10 to the 4 difference. And what effective field theory provided for us was a prediction of the shape of this resonance. And this is measurements at a rather low temperature, but not so low. This is down at a few nanokelvin, so getting very low. And prediction of effective field theory comes from the zero temperature prediction. And you can see these things look like they're very nicely approaching this zero temperature prediction of effective field theory. So it allowed us to look at this problem in a way to be able to predict the line shape of this Efimov resonance that was verified in experiment. So that's one example. The other example I want to mention goes back to Bose-Einstein condensation. Back in 1925, Einstein predicted that matter should, well, ideal gas of bosons should have this strange property that they would form a Bose-Einstein condensate at low densities. The thermal de Broglie, okay, here's his prediction for the critical temperature. Tc is some numerical factor times density to the 2/3 power. It's basically the condition that the phase space density, number density times thermal de Broglie wavelength cubed, is close to 1. It turns out it's 2.6 when this effect turns on. And one of an obvious question is, okay, well, ideal gases are nice. What about real gases with interactions? So what is the shift of Tc for interactions? And amazingly, this was an unsolved problem until about 2005. And again, I ran out of time to put down the appropriate references, so forgive me for that. But okay, so the problem is, well, a simple, you can ask what is the critical temperature of real molecules. You could also ask that's kind of a difficult question, but you can ask the simple question. Suppose you have weak interactions described by a scattering length, or if you have hard spheres with a scattering length, a hard sphere of radius A, what is the shift in Tc? And the solution came from effective field theory. In this case, it's an effective field theory for the fluctuations near the critical point, which it turns out are described by a statistical field theory in 3 dimensions. So it's one that it's more complicated than the story I presented. But the answer is that the result is just linear in the scattering length, which sounds like an easy result, but with a coefficient that the only way we know how to calculate it is to use Monte Carlo simulations. And these have given the coefficient of 1.8. But this is a coefficient effective field theory. And just like those coefficients for the photons, once you determine those coefficients in Lagrangian, you can describe all the low energy physics. This should also describe other aspects of low energy physics, other aspects of behavior near the critical point for Bose-Einstein condensation. Okay, so we can ask entrapped gases. No, it's just a phi to the fourth field theory. It's phi to the fourth in 3 Euclidean dimensions, so it's very simple, but you have to solve it non-perturbatively, which means lattice calculations. So what about trapped atoms? Well, in this case, the behavior near the critical point is different from the case of a homogeneous gas, and that's because Bose-Einstein condensation sets in at the center of the trap here. It's this very, at the very center, you're starting to get a Bose-Einstein condensate, whereas in the uniform case, you're getting it everywhere. So it's Bose-Einstein condensation sets in locally, and that makes the problem different. It makes it insensitive to this coefficient in the effective field theory that's governing the critical fluctuations. But so the shift in Tc is not a good observable to be sensitive to critical fluctuations, but the condensate fraction is. And just this year, there were precise measurements of the condensate fraction in a trapped Bose-Einstein condensate by a group at Cambridge, and they find very good agreement with this coefficient from effective field theory if you use it to predict the condensate fraction. I have to apologize I'm going to stop right here. I received instructions that I should try to make the talk 45 minutes, and I might have tried too hard, but let me just conclude. Effective field theory, it is a universal language in high-energy physics for describing not only low-energy approximations to a system, but also for model-independent framework for higher-energy physics. It's proving to be very effective method to apply to ultra-cold atoms. I gave you a couple of very simple examples here. Maybe there's a problem of interest to you where this method might be fruitful. Anyway, thank you very much for listening.